My name is David Bella, and I'm here to lead a discussion. I hope it's a discussion and not a lecture on the military-industrial complex. My background, I'm an engineer. I tend to be kind of a rebellious engineer, tend to the distress of my university, study topics that engineers normally don't study, such as theology and the military-industrial complex, when they would rather have me writing research proposals to get money into the university. But that makes me fit into Holden a lot better. So I'm at home now, and I'm just enjoying it immensely. I want to talk today about the military-industrial complex, and I'll try not to lecture too much. I'll start off with a quote, and it's one of the most often quoted sayings of a president, the contemporary president of the United States, and I'll read it. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. This same president wrote, "The total influence of this military-industrial complex, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government." He goes on and he says, "We must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society." Now, this was not Ronald Reagan. This was Dwight Eisenhower. And this was his farewell address to the American people upon leaving office. Now, one of the reasons why this speech and that phrase military-industrial complex has been so important, I think, is because it gives credibility, or it allows people to criticize at least a little bit more the military-industrial complex. Because if you've ever gotten in a debate over the military-industrial complex, you find there's a tendency for people to say, "Oh, what are you, a communist, or what are you, a socialist, or are you anti-American," or something like that, that somehow criticizing the system is anti-American. And so if you can bring an authority figure such as Dwight Eisenhower, a Republican, a general, a president on your side, and you can start out your talk by quoting Eisenhower, it gets the heat off. Now that's really important, and people use it in this way. Well, what I'd like to do is ask the question, first of all, and I think it's important for us to ask, is that a legitimate use of Eisenhower? And we don't like to misuse people or misquote people, and so I think it's important for us, you know, even if we are criticizing the military-industrial establishment, to ask if indeed this is an appropriate quote, or are we quoting out of context? Now, there are several arguments that say, "Oh, that's, you shouldn't use that Eisenhower's words," and they fall into the general category. Well, Ike really didn't mean that. Okay, he really didn't mean it. And there's two categories of this. One is, well, you know, Eisenhower, he was a nice guy. He wasn't a particularly forceful person. And so, you know, some speechwriter probably slipped it in and he just went along with it. So it was just kind of this random event that speechwriter just happened to like that and they slipped it in. And Eisenhower was kind of a easygoing president, liked to play golf, and that was the attitude. The other attitude is, wait a minute, this is just one thing Eisenhower said. If you look at his whole life, you find that he behaved differently in his whole life. He was a general, and even after he got out of the presidency, when he left, he really didn't write or speak a lot about this military-industrial complex, so it really must not have been that important to him. He really didn't say anything after he left, and certainly if it was important, he would have written written some material and said something after he left. Those are the two arguments. They're related arguments. Well, how credible are those arguments? I don't think either one is credible. I think Eisenhower really meant it, and let me explain why. Some of the work I've done in reading up on Eisenhower involves historians going back and studying his administration. And they are finding out that he was a very forceful and activist president. This doesn't ring our image of Eisenhower. And how do they do this research? Well, they go back and they look at his schedule that he had. Okay, and then they go and they take, and he had a very full schedule, and he met with all of these people. I mean, the key people, such as Dulles. Remember, Dulles was the Secretary of State. He says, well, what happened there? Well, they go back and they look at the notes, and they look, for example, if Eisenhower gave a speech, they look at the early drafts of the speech, because then you can find out who really did it. And they find out that Eisenhower had them redo those drafts over and over, and he put little footnotes all in there, and they're amazed at how much he was involved in. Now, Eisenhower liked to be liked. That was part of it. He liked to be liked. And he wasn't a person to jump on a bandwagon. He didn't like hype. You know, he really didn't like that. So if someone else took the heat for some decisions, such as John Foster Dulles, that was okay with Eisenhower. Dulles knew who was in charge. You see, that was kind of Eisenhower's style. And Dulles, of course, we always thought of him as an outspoken and a very radical Secretary of State. Well, Eisenhower thought that was pretty good because that would keep the liberals off his back and it would pacify the conservatives, the more militant conservatives, which was a big concern of Eisenhower. So, okay, let Dulles do that. But they found out that Dulles would always check in with Eisenhower. Oh, I mean, in fact, this one guy found he was gone. Dulles was gone overseas somewhere. And they had four feet of notes and telegrams that came back from Dulles always checking with Eisenhower. And they used to joke about this. Eisenhower, therefore, was an activist president. We cannot accept the notion that somebody else slipped this in. If Eisenhower said it was an important concern, we have to accept it. He believed it. He was not about the kind of person that was going to let somebody else slip this in on him. So I think we have to reject the notion that Eisenhower was kind of this weak person and he really didn't mean this. Well, what about the other criticism? That really Eisenhower really didn't mean this, and if he really did, he would have later gone on and written more about it and spoke more about it. What about that criticism? I don't think that's valid either. And in order to understand that, you have to look at the historical situation. Remember, Eisenhower at that time was beaten by, he wasn't defeated. He didn't rerun for re-election, but Nixon was defeated. Remember that? And by Kennedy. And do you remember what one of the big issues of that campaign was? The missile gap. Remember the missile gap? Okay, remember that? Where the Democrats were the ones criticizing the Republicans because the Republicans had left the military, you know, they hadn't supported the military, and the Russians now had all these missiles and so many more than we did. Remember that? That was the big missile. So you see, Eisenhower is being criticized at that time for not supporting the military enough. So that makes it all the more difficult for him to say something like this politically. But you have to go back and say, well, why in the 60s, after he was president of the United States, didn't he speak out more? Well, he spoke out a little bit in his memoirs. And in his memoirs, he says very briefly, he says, I wanted to say the most important thing I could to the American people, and this was one of them. That's what he says. So he says that later. But he doesn't go into great detail. He doesn't go ahead and become involved in the controversies of the 60s. Well, I think you have to appreciate who Eisenhower was. He was older. He was facing retirement. He died a few years later than that. He was a military officer. And he had, of course, a feeling for the American soldier. He did. And at that time, we were involved in Vietnam. And this would have been extremely difficult for him to go ahead and criticize, openly criticize, because he was an ex-military officer and American soldiers were dying. I think that would be a very difficult thing for him to do. Second of all, when you retire from a job, there are certain kinds of responsibility. It's like a minister in a church, and they've been a minister for a long time, and then they retire. And let's say a controversy occurs in the church. Do you come back and get involved in that thing? Usually not. Usually people say, well, I'll be kind of the distant person. If someone wants to talk and be nurturing, and I'll help out. And I think Eisenhower felt very much that way. And instead, what he did is he wrote his memoirs, which I think is important. I mean, he had to write his memoirs because that's something unique that he could give. So I would say then that if people wish to criticize the military-industrial complex, then I think it is valid for them to go ahead and cite Eisenhower. It is valid. I think it's a legitimate thing to do. When you do that, however, you have to realize that Eisenhower was not anti-military or anti-industry. He was not. So you can't use it to say, let's get rid of the military, because Eisenhower didn't say that. In his own speech, he says the military is necessary, but he's scared about it. Okay, he's worried about its influence on American society. So you can't misquote him. We have a responsibility for that. Okay. So we have to be careful not to misquote Eisenhower on that. Well, we have no way of really knowing exactly what Eisenhower had in mind. And I think maybe Eisenhower didn't know exactly what he had in mind. He had an experience, and I think this was a way of him telling his story, in a sense. And I think you have to think of it as storytelling. He was part of the military system himself. Some of the things that he did, particularly after World War II, actually really got the military-industrial complex rolling. Then he left the military, and he was, what, president of Columbia University? I think it was Columbia University. President of the university. That's important. You see, later he has something to say about the universities in his speech. So he leaves there, and then he becomes president of the United States. And, of course, he's involved in this whole military buildup, unprecedented during peacetime, during the 1950s. Okay? Well, let's suppose you've been part of an establishment. Say you're a minister in the church, or you're working in some... And then you're on the outside, and you've got all these people coming asking you for money. And they're saying how important it is. Well, you know what the games are, right? Because you're part, those are your peers that are there, okay? You know what they are. And sometimes the people who are in the inside, and they get on the outside, they become the most stingy in terms of giving money, because they know how it's wasted because they were in it. And this is Eisenhower's experience. This is his experience, you see. He was the most stingy president we had. He would check on everything, and he'd go back to those generals and he'd tell them, I know what's going on here. He knew. He knew what was going on. And the military budget actually declined during Eisenhower's tenure as president. And despite the fact that he really believed we needed a strong military, despite the fact. And yet, at the end of his career, he was criticized by the Democrats, in this case, for not supporting the military. And there was this huge amount of need for the military. According to this military-industrial establishment, you had industries and lobbyists and think tanks and the military and all this, telling all the American people how much they needed, what this tremendous missile gap was. And he just said, I just don't believe it. Was, what do you mean? Here's the CIA. The CIA's estimates actually were lower because they didn't have as vested interest. The Air Force had the highest estimate because they were the ones needing the money to build the planes and the rockets. The Army had a lower estimate of the number of rockets that the Russians had because, of course, they didn't want the money to go to build planes and rockets. They wanted the money to go for conventional troops. Well, Eisenhower could see that the amount of rockets that the Soviets apparently had depended upon how much money the particular branch of the military service wanted. The Air Force wanted the money for planes, and so the more rockets the Russians had, the more rockets the Air Force could justify. And so the Air Force estimates were the highest. The CIA didn't get a whole lot out of this, okay? And so their estimates were the lowest. Well, Eisenhower could see this, but how could he come to grips with it? We need more. Well, he did a few things I read. For example, he wanted to find out whether they would just, you know, you start looking at how many bombs they have, and he says, how do I get a handle on this? I mean, how do I get a handle on this? And of course, if you try to study it, you just can't do it. The information is just so complex. So he sent his advisor, science advisor, over to check. Are these guys overdoing it? And how do you check on that if you're one person? Well, what the guy did, as I recall, is he went to look in the Soviet Union to find a city that came the closest to Hiroshima as possible. Okay? And then he found out how many megatons or whatever it was that they had targeted for that particular city. And then he compared it to how much we actually dropped on Hiroshima, and he found out that the amount that they were targeting for these cities was enormous compared to the amount that they had already dropped. So he says, they're just overestimating. Okay, I thought that was kind of a clever way to do it. So Eisenhower was extremely distressed. I think he was distressed, the information that was coming back. And then the Democrats picked up on, there was 500 rockets out there. We've got to spend more money. Even Nixon, who was running, by that time, didn't even ask Eisenhower to help him in the campaign, if you remember that, until the very last. And Eisenhower was very hurt by that. I mean, Eisenhower was kind of rejected on this. And later, by the way, when they put up some satellites to find out how many rockets that the Soviet Union had, they were claiming 500, and some estimates were higher. Do you know how many they found? Four ICBMs. And big, bulky things. They don't even know where they'd get off the ground. So the information had been hyped. Okay, so this is Eisenhower's response. Well, I went back and I said, what is a military-industrial complex? I said, Eisenhower had some legitimate feelings. His experience led him to believe something's going on here that I don't like. He wasn't a theoretician, though. He didn't come up with a systems model of how organizational complexes behave. That's something I might do. I don't have the experience Eisenhower did. I think Eisenhower was right to write his memoirs to tell his story about his experiences. Okay? But nevertheless, you'd think that the people who followed Eisenhower would go back and study this thing called the military-industrial complex. Well, there has been a fair amount of study, but most of it has been kind of ideologically motivated. Okay? Most of it is, you already know what the people are going to say before they even start doing the study. And a lot of it has to do with just money. Look how much money so-and-so made on this contract. Look how much, you know, they've got this little bolt that you can buy in a hardware store for 13 cents, and they sold it to the military for $59.75 or something like that. You've seen this in the news media, a lot of this. There's a lot of whodunits studies. So-and-so was a general or a colonel in the military. Then they took up a job in Northrop Aviation. Then Northrop Aviation got this contract. You see a lot of that kind of reporting. But one of the things that I didn't find is a basic understanding of the nature of a complex. What is a complex? Okay? What is a complex? Well, you have any ideas? What would be a complex? Not just a military industrial, but maybe, you know, it doesn't just have to be military, but we can stick to that. Let's focus on the word complex and see what we can come up with. What do you think a complex is in the context of Eisenhower's? Yeah.
Well, it's a large, multifaceted, multi-parted organization that acts in symbiosis. If you start cutting off one part, you're actually killing other parts. In other words, they can't exist without each other together. They exist in such concert that you start lopping off parts, you're going to start killing other parts that may not seem to be related.
Okay, a large self-reinforcing system, symbiotic system. Okay, somebody else want to add some words on that?
He had used the word organization. That sounds like it's an organized attempt. But he used the word system just now.
Yeah.
To me, that sounds, it's an unconscious kind of a thing, is it?
Right. Okay. Unconscious. You agree with that? Okay. There are organizations in it that have administrative hierarchies, but it's more than that.
Yes.
Nobody's in charge. It's a self-perpetuating, self-reinforcing kind of system, okay?
Simpler explanation is a can of worms.
Okay, a can of worms. It's this complex kind of thing that has an entity that has self-reinforcing kinds of behaviors. Somebody else want to add on that?
Just the idea that there's no single monitor.
Okay, there's no single monitor. No one's in charge. No one's in charge. No one can be blamed. Okay?
Like mold, it continues to grow.
It continues to grow all by itself. Okay? All by itself. Right. Something else. Anybody else want to add? I think that's pretty good. Now, I thought that when I go to the literature, I would find, as an engineer, systems engineer, I would find some papers on exactly what you've described. This self-organizing entity of reinforcing behaviors, symbiotic behaviors that tends to grow, that is not in charge of anyone, but it's kind of an adapting system. And I found very little in the literature on that. So I said, well, what's going on here? Anyhow, what I did in the long run, make a long story short, I wrote a paper on an adapting system. How does a complex adapt? Okay, and what are the properties of a system, a complex system, just as you've described it, but I try to make it, maybe use a little bit more technical language. And my intention on this, and why I'm here actually to get some help, is because I intend to actually publish this in a journal of systems engineers, because they're the ones that work for this military-industrial complex. I want to publish a paper as a systems paper on the very system that they're in. They may not like that, but anyhow. That's, and your perception, you see, is exactly the one I ended up with, that a self-reinforcing kind of system. Okay? Now let me tell you, I developed a model, and I'll tell you very roughly how that model operates in words. I'm still working on it. I said a complex involves people. Okay? It involves average, ordinary people. And those of you who went to John Schramm's talk with Thomas Merton, and he read from the paper about Eichmann, and he said Eichmann was sane. That's one of the frightening things. He was part of a military-industrial complex, and he was sane. These are ordinary people that run it. We can't go look for, the psychopaths and all. It's ordinary people. So I said ordinary people. Each person is in a unique environment. Okay? An environment. The environment of the president of a particular corporation is different than the environment of a system research engineer working on a project, is different than the environment of a corporal who's out there running a squad, is different than whatever else might, the different environments. We all are in different environments. And those environments have certain strands of information coming into them and resources. Information. Our environment is largely informational. We have certain kinds of messages that we receive. Particularly in our job, you get certain information that comes back. Engineers have it in the form of equations and tables and graphs, and other people have it in other ways. The information, some of it is formal, much of it is informal. The people you talk with by the coffee break. That's an informational input into your environment. Okay? Okay, so that's what it is. Now, these environments are part of a network where the information transfers from one environment to another. And the decisions that every person, you and I, let's put it that way, you and I in this environment, let's not talk about it as those people out there, is based upon the information that surrounds us, right? So we want to behave rationally, make a good decision. We respond to the information that surrounds us. You get that? But that information is part of a network that goes to other people's environments. And it's an adapting network. It adapts. Okay? Now, how does it adapt? Well, when something creates a disorder, such as information that creates a disorder, the system tends to change. Okay? You come up with a report and say, gee, this thing, you know, if this thing comes out, you know, we're liable to lose such and such a contract. That creates a disorder in the system. Now, what would an honest person do then? Well, the honest person certainly wouldn't tear up the report. But what you might do is send it back for some people to check out the data, the information. Well, every time you send it back, there's a certain probability that it will go ahead and get altered. You know, just a certain random probability. And what happens is the information that comes through any environment that's favorable to the system has a higher probability of making it through the environment than information that's unfavorable. Okay? So what happens is the system tends to filter out unfavorable information. And the most unfavorable information is that kind of information that will cut off resources to the system. Okay? And the most favorable information is that kind of information that will justify resources to the system. Now, you see this all the time. You see people writing research proposals. They give all this information about how important it is what they're doing so that they can get the money. You're actually competing to see who can produce the most favorable information. Well, the end result in this whole system is that the system acts to filter out unfavorable information, and it tends to heighten and produce and display favorable information, where favorable information is whatever information sustains the system. And yet, it does not require any one person to be dishonest, because each person is in their little environment, and each person responds to the best available information, which, of course, is biased, okay, because of the system. Okay. In other words, a system an organizational complex has the capacity to distort information while at the same time providing environments for everybody where everybody feels like their own behavior is justified and proper. Okay? And this is not a conspiracy. It's part of the symbiosis that you describe, part of the can of worms that happens, the words that you used. The information, just as it winds its way through there, as the resources are allocated in this system, it has a higher probability of producing at every junction, a very slight probability, higher probability of producing favorable information than unfavorable information. And it sustains the values of the system itself. Now, the people who are in this system, their perceptions are changed by the system. They are altered because all of our perceptions are changed by the information that comes into us. And you can actually go and see the people who are in the system the longest. And in the center of the system, their perceptions get changed to the point where you're shocked by what they really believe. But of course, they don't hear you because you're not connected to them. They're protected by layers and layers of other people surrounding them in the system. One of the generals for the Strategic Air Command, I don't know whether it was Tommy Powers, that's a good name, Powers, or Curtis LeMay, basically describing nuclear war, said, look, and his language was more crude than mine, but he says, the purpose is to kill them. And if at the end of all this, there's two of us left and one of them, we win. Oh, that's crazy. But it was rational within the interior parts of this system. Now, what happened when Kennedy finally came? So, before Kennedy came, this system was generating information. The Russians have all of these missiles. Because at each point, and once they generated the information, they have all these missiles. Anybody who might question this, of course, you're crazy. What do you mean the Russians only have 100? We know they have 500. What are you, crazy? So, of course, people didn't, they lose credibility in the system. Well, the Russians only had 4. Well, Eisenhower experienced that. He didn't know how to deal with it. He recognized that he had once been in the system, and even now he was sort of in the system, but it just wasn't fitting together, and that's why he wrote that. Kennedy comes along. He wins 500 missiles. He goes into this thing, okay?
Bay of Pigs, yeah, we've got to get them. We can do it. It's a disaster. They find out there's only four of us. He starts getting really suspicious then of the system himself. Little stories came. There are people who are wrapped up in the system, like Edward Teller. I mean, there is a man who was in the middle of that system. Anybody who's called father of the H-bomb, you know, emotionally has to believe that it's right. I mean, you know. And there was one scene, I can't remember the details of this, but the new outsiders of the system came in and they began hearing these other people's perceptions of how we're going to deal with the Soviets. And they became horrified. Okay? And the one way, there was one story, I think it was Edward Teller, and I think it was Sorensen. I'm not sure, I get the names kind of mixed up. But Teller comes in and explains what we have to do. And this aide of Kennedy's is so shocked at the bizarreness. He's tempted to tell Teller he's crazy, but Teller's an influential person. But instead he says, gee, you ought to speak to the president about this. And he takes Teller into the president, and he gives him the big speech, and Kennedy's about aghast. And he cuts the pro. He behaves opposite to what Teller wanted. So there are some feedbacks in this. Okay, so here we have a complex that is capable of taking decent, ordinary people, good, God-fearing people, putting them in an environment, nurturing them in that environment through a system that distorts information. And the system is not just military-industrial. The educational system can be drawn into it, the church system, all of this can be drawn into it. Okay, that's a problem. Yeah,
you're talking, I'm thinking too, a family system affected by the disease of alcoholism also fits in.
Yes, you can see smaller. One of the advantages of a small system, though, is the problem so jumps out at you that you finally reach the stage where you cannot ignore it, where the person just is so irresponsible that you have to come and admit it. Okay. And unfortunately, with a large military-industrial complex, we can reach the stage of where people, here's the extent to which the distortion can occur. That people who are dedicated Christians, who are rational people, who care for their families, can actually sit down and plan how to go ahead and very efficiently bring about 10 Holocausts within 20 minutes. I mean, it reaches that stage. I mean, that's what it is. At the same time, though, we can't. It's hard because we can't just throw out all of their information. One of the dangers when you have a complex is it will lose so much credibility that you'll throw out the good information with the bad. We can't be arrogant and assume that they're all wrong and we're all right. Okay? Because you see, the Soviets have a military-industrial complex too. Theirs is much more totalitarian than ours. It is. Let's not kid ourselves. It's less open to criticism. It's less efficient, unfortunately, in some ways than ours. But in fact, the two military complexes, they get in a synergistic relationship. I could talk about that. There's a good tape on that in the library. Well, I maintain that this whole notion of a complex, military-industrial complex, poses a challenge, certainly to the church. The church is called to be both part of the society and not part of the society. Tom, I think, gave a... There's a Bible verse on that, isn't there? Somebody want to give me...
In the world, but not of the world.
In the world, but not of the world. See, we're beginning to get some idea. If this is a system of tremendous distortion, you can't ignore it. You can't reject... You're in it. You've got to accept the fact that you and I are in the military-industrial complex. But we can't be of it. And that's not an easy, it's a crazy, in fact, in some ways, how do we deal with that? How do we deal with that? Now, I suggest that as we begin to understand the military-industrial complex, we're going to end up with new theological insights, because what it's going to do is going to challenge us to what we mean by knowledge, for example. What we mean by truth. Because if we're all part of the system, and how can we rely on anything? And if the system distorts, You see, those are the kinds of questions that come up. If that's the case, how do we tell when we get true information? We can't just throw out the military, because I didn't say that everything they say is false. I didn't say that. Much of what they say, I think, has got some truth to it. But how do we sort that out from the distortions? As we begin to ask those questions, we begin to start questioning the nature of knowledge and truth and our relationship to it. And in my view, we find out that the scientific notion of truth is not enough. You see, science, the scientific method, that's a word that's overdone, but I'll use it now anyhow, is fine, except it doesn't tell you what kinds of questions to ask. You see? And one of the biases that comes from science is they respond to the kinds of questions that the system funds. And one of the ways to bias information is to ask certain questions and not ask other kinds of questions. And there's nothing in science that helps you to tell you what kinds of questions to ask. So science automatically, by its susceptibility to not question what the questions are, okay, is biased. The computer is going to contribute to this distortion. Once you build this on a huge computer system, it becomes essentially impossible for anyone to criticize it. If you've had to go through a large computer program, it's extremely difficult. There's very few people. The only people who understand went into it are the modelers, the actual people who did it. This is my area, so I can say it. And even they don't understand it eventually. And this computer model gains a life all of its own, and no one knows what its assumptions really are, particularly when taken holistically. Is that going to be the basis of truth? No. What about mathematics? Is that certainly math? There's the truth. Well, about 30% of the mathematicians are employed in the military-industrial complex. The people who've come up with the theories of counterforce, which means we attack them first before they attack us, that have rationalized it have been the mathematicians and the economists. The mathematician can tell you what logical consistencies are. Okay? That's what they can do. But they can't tell you whether the assumptions are right, morally right, or even physically right. In other words, the notion of truth as we find in mathematics, as we find in computers, and find in science, may be necessary, but it's not sufficient. It's not sufficient. We have to look for a broader knowledge of truth that involves questioning, the actual responsibility for the questioning, and more than that. That actually has to seek for some source outside of the system. Now, I think that's about as close as you can get to a definition of religion without using the religious language. Okay? We must have the source, the grounding, the inspiration, the motivation, the call must come from outside of the system itself. And it must always be accompanied by what? Humility. By a willingness to listen to the others, and by a realization that we basically are wrong, that we actually participate in a distorted process. In other words, it has to rely upon grace. It has to accept the fact that we have a distorted view of the world. That's a given. Now, we've got to do the best we can to unravel that, but in the end, we are wrong. And we are not justified because we have all the right answers. We are justified by something outside of the system. And we have to accept in humility that we ourselves are part of the system. And that comes about as close to an introduction of Christian theology as you can get without using church language. Okay, that's my thing. I live in a secular world. I can't use the church language in an engineering class. Okay? We get there just the same. Okay? What I'm suggesting to you then is by examining organizational complexes, and as I hope to say later in the week, by examining the limitations of the technological devices and enterprises and ways of thinking that we have in our society, we can end up with a new awareness, a greater awareness of our own religious roots. There is a danger, however, that the very religion that we have, and I mean religion with a capital R and a small r, I guess, itself can be wrapped up by the system. Itself can be taken over by the system, and we should assume that we are part of that. We can't point the finger elsewhere. Well, we have to point the finger elsewhere, but we always have to realize when we point, unless you got a taped finger like mine, that when you have one finger out that way, you want three come back the other way, or four, depending how many you got. Okay, so we have to accept our participation in it. That's, I think, part of the gospel message. Okay, I'll open it up. I think we've got enough time for some discussion or observation. Somebody want to ask them? Yeah, Tom.
One of the things that bothers me, you know, we start talking about other systems being brought into it, and other parts of it, our daily life being brought into it, especially as the political system. It's so easy to see, for instance, the one B-1 bomber, it has parts that are built in like 47 of the 50 states.
That's right.
And you have a problem. You may have a very very liberal congressman, for instance, who says, I don't want the B-1 bomber, but then when his constituents come back, say, hey, I work for Rockwell. We have $10 million worth of parts a month go out of a plant here for the B-1 bomber. It's very difficult. But he's tied up with his political perspective.
I think there's several things that we realize. One, that the issue of the arms race and war has to also be tied up with justice. The idea that we have some people out there whose families are held hostages, that they're going to be thrown out and be destitute because somehow we're not going to build a weapon that can carry, a thousand times the destructive power of Hiroshima, or whatever it might be. I mean, that's the point. I mean, that's absurdity. I mean, that's it. We need a hostage ethics. We have to develop. We have to say, how do we protect the hostages? That's one thing. One thing we have to learn. The other thing, I think, is we all have to learn to maybe live it a little bit less so we don't depend so much on this large technological system. I don't know the answer, though, but you're right. What you said is absolutely
well,
right.
I mean, you know, what kind of tactics can we use to... You're not going to cut it off or, contain it entirely, but what can you use to, fill the breach and, in other words, keep this from, intruding over, spilling over and getting ever bigger and to the point where
I can't tell you how to solve the problem. I think we need to each one of us try to look to see what we can do. And I realize that's kind of a short and almost a cliche type of answer. We've got to work on the problem. I can't give you a bridge. I wish I could.
Well, we idolize jobs. That's what we're doing.
Yeah.
What happened in the time of the Reformation? Catholics at that time, you had the cathedral builders in Europe, and put a lot of people out of work when a Reformation took place. We didn't really build cathedrals in the same way. Maybe that's the situation with jobs now. We're idolizing some of these military industrial jobs, and we've got to find a way to phase them out.
For myself, I've been rather distressed with the university, because the university, I realize, it's not going to be the savior of the world, but the university has this tradition of independent thinking, and it's being drawn into the system by people who don't even perceive that there is a system. Eisenhower, incidentally, warned about that. This guy, there's some sentences that have remarkable insights. Let me read this to you. This is Eisenhower speaking in 1961. The free university, historically the fountainhead of free ideas and scientific discovery, has experienced a revolution in the conduct of research. Partly because of the huge cost involved, a government contract becomes a virtual substitute for intellectual curiosity. Okay? The prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocation, and the power of money is ever present and is gravely to be regarded.
He has hit the university right on the head, folks. Let me tell you, I'm part of it. He's described exactly what's here, at least in engineering. You make it in the university by hustling money and contracts. And when you do that, you become part of the system. And the independent kind of thought that we need to kind of nurture this, to at least expose some of these distortions or work on them or provide alternative questioning, that gets sacrificed. Now, I don't think the university is going to save the world, but at least my role in the university, I ought to, you know, that's what I have to do. You had your hand.
Yeah, one fascinating incident that took place within the last year that really showed the inner workings of the military-industrial complex. It was a battle between Boeing and Lockheed for the C-5B troop transport. And this is a relatively unemotional issue as far as morality goes. I mean, you're not talking about a weapon that's going to blow off half the earth. But it was just, it was fascinating because here you had the military-industrial complex arguing amongst itself. You had the bureaucracy within the military and different branches of the military,
yes,
arguing, giving one set of facts on which troop transport cargo plane would be better. You had Boeing giving their facts. You had Lockheed lobbying, giving their facts. You had the GAO getting their information. You had various intellectual organizations giving, like the Rand Corporation, giving their information. Then you had the various state governments
giving theirs,
judges, senators, which has a very powerful member of the military, none. And then you had Washington with Jackson, who's a very powerful senator, giving information. And it was incredible, the information that was given on this. As it turned out, the Senate voted for the Boeing plane, and then they reversed themselves, had another vote, and voted for the Lockheed plane. Prior to all this, they had initially voted and decided on giving the contract, I believe, to Douglas or one of the other aircraft manufacturers. And, you know, so they had three different corporations all giving possibly misinformation. But the real amazing thing was the way that I was really scared of almost was the dealings of the military bureaucracy. Because you have the military, you have such a large bureaucracy within, like, the Air Force, and you have your own clique of people that have dealt with a certain member of the industrial community, and they're trying to save their jobs because they're an expert on what Lockheed does. And if they give the contract to Boeing, they're in effect really kind of losing their job, or they're going to be transferred to another area.
That's what keeps the system going. You see, one of the things, the properties of this system, is that information and resources are tightly coupled, or highly related. And so everybody has to, if they want the resources, everybody has to produce information to justify the resources. You see? So the information, in a sense, becomes biased. And there's competition in there, okay? And even though they're competing, of course, one of the things collectively they're doing is affirming the larger system, because every one of them is saying, of course we need this plane. Of course we need a bigger military. Of course the Russians, they're all agreeing at that higher level. In fact, they're competing with each other to see who can agree with that the most by saying, my plane will solve this even better than all the rest of them, because of course there's this huge problem. So at the one level, you see, you have disagreement. At the other level, it fosters this perception of how much more we need. And the key to this is the connection between information and resources. As soon as you have that tight connection, you find that people produce the information that they think needs to get the resources. That's why this business about having universities having to go out and chase dollars, Eisenhower felt was bad, because they'll start teaching the stuff that allows them to get the dollars back, they'll start doing the research that allows them to get the contracts back, rather than taking a different view. So you're right.
And then good Christians in Central King County, who may have nothing to do with Boeing, when he hears that the
20,000 Boeing workers may be laid off and the school system may suffer for his kids because Boeing doesn't get the contract, suffers. And I mean, he enters and he sucks right in. That's what I'm just saying, geez.
Right, it's a complex step.
Well, as I understand, the Boeing transports were already built and they could not accept those planes because that was outside the military specifications. And that's why those Boeing did not get the contract. Yes. As I understand, it's that 13-cent bolt. They wanted for 257.
Okay, now the one thing I want to say, when we study these individual, and they're fascinating. The one on the David, the anti-aircraft gun, is fascinating study. We have to keep in mind the larger complex that I've described. It's very easy to get involved, and then when you do that, you become lost in the details, and you begin to say, boy, they're getting paid more than they deserve, or they have this particular influence over here. What I'm trying to get at with the whole system is our perceptions, our knowledge, our information in the whole process runs the danger of being terribly distorted, and we have to protect that information. You see? Yeah, I'll go here and then I'll come back.
Yeah, it seems that what you've been talking about all morning is a paranoia, a scare.
That's part of it.
And what do we do to protect ourselves from the scare? I had a discussion with Elmer Abramson a year ago, and he suggested that there probably won't be a conflict between the communists and the capitalists. There are thinkers in both groups. It will be between the paranoid and those who think.
That could be. The only problem with the system I've described is I'm not sure I can tell a difference, because the system I've described, you can have rational people coming up with ideas that people should be paranoid about or should be terrified with. Yeah.
They're still dealing with the scare. Without dealing with the scare.
Yes, without dealing with it. That's a good point. Because in the system, we can have people doing calculations about potentially killing tens of millions of people without getting scared. Now, who's sick? I mean, you know, but within that environment of the system, we have a problem. But, all right, the fear, though, there's another dimension to the fear I want to bring up here, because it's important we have to deal with. One of the things I have found, and you've mentioned it to me, several of you have mentioned it to me, that when we start, as Christians, even in a church, even at Holden, we start talking about the military, it gets terribly depressing, it gets terribly draining, you end up having, I do, bad dreams, you have to break away from it. Somehow, as a Christian community, we have to bring into our discussions the grace, the joy, and it sounds crazy to be joyful and at the same time studying, you know, or examining the question of the fate of the earth, the destruction of the society. But whoever said that Christianity had to be rational, there is an irrational joy that we have to kind of bring back, or else what's going to happen is it will be so painful and distressing, and I speak from experience, a lot of I know you have out there, that you just ignore the topic. And then the only information that happens is what goes through the system. So somehow we have to be a nurturing community that keeps joy, an absurd community. Yeah.
Well, the fear is that they're going to get it.
Well,
and so far, yeah. I haven't heard any of the industrial or the military people talk about loving our enemy to the point where they become friends, which is the only sure way of destroying any enemy.
That's you're right. I mean, that doesn't fit through the system. That kind of information doesn't fit through the system. At the same time, I think, though, we have to be self-critical. Because a lot of times I do see there's a lot of Christian cliches that get thrown around at complex problems. You know, if we only loved everybody, that becomes the answer to everything. And it's more difficult than that. quite often. I think you were raising the point the other night. And so we always have to go ahead, as we criticize others, we have to stop back and we have to self-criticize. That's part of repentance. And we have to realize that we don't have the answer. And part of, we can't, in the process of loving the enemy that are the Russians, we can't make an enemy of, you know, our own military. I mean, there's a lot of problems that happen there. And yet we have to deal with
this. Is that part of the scare?
That's part of the scare. But there's a lot of scares that people are afraid to say, raise certain questions because maybe they won't be responding as a good Christian. People are afraid, well, gee, I'm not in favor of unilateral disarmament. And if I say that, maybe people will say I'm not really a Christian. That's a fear too. That's a fear too that people say that. Well, it seems to me a Christian community ought to be a good community to deal with fear. All fears, everybody's fears. Fears that we promote among each other and fears that of the Russians and fear of each other in a group speaking out. And the only way to do that is just start in the beginning and assume that we're going to be wrong, but we're called to deal with this anyhow, and that's why we've got grace. And it's absurd, but that's what we're going to do. And I think we have to remind ourselves of that, or else these big problems will be so big that we won't deal with them, and that's the way to turn a system loose. Eisenhower said, they asked him, how do you propose the solution to the problem? Where does it lie? And he says, in an active and informed and alert citizenry. That's all he could come up with. Now, he lived his life and he wrote the speech, and I'm not sure we can come up with a better answer than that. So let's be active, informed, and involved.
Others protest if we feel a protest is the
that's
thing.
That's right. That's right. I think that's right. I think the protest, what the protest quite often does is it conveys information in drama. It's acted out drama. You can see that. And it conveys the horror quite often and the absurdity of the whole enterprise. I'm not saying everyone should be a protester. You know, maybe the world would be a disaster if everyone was. I mean, but nevertheless, as a community, that has a role too. Providing we don't get arrogant in the process, and I've seen that happen in several occasions where people think of them as saints, themselves as saints. That's not very Christian either. But you're right, isn't it? That's part, yeah.
How about Hyman Rickover? Have you studied some of the things that he's...
Just in the news media, he apparently has become extremely critical of the whole system, particularly as he's gotten out of it. And that happens with some people, like, you know, you get out of the system and all of a sudden you start, particularly as you're approaching death, and you start looking back on your life and you begin...
Well, I think he was kind of speaking out, though, even before he was...
Could be, yeah.
He was...
Somebody else want to add?
But the whole concept then, you know, of paranoia, if you live in a state of grace, you have no fear. So you can have a sense of humor about things. Yeah. And if you have a sense of humor and you're not afraid, you know, it's easy to put down a paranoid. It's really easy to put down a paranoid. But it's very hard to put down someone who is not afraid and who's just, you know, who has a sense of humor.
Let me see if I could rephrase it. I think we do get afraid.
Yeah.
But we have the humor in spite of the fact that
we're afraid.
In fact, that's the nation. The notion of faith is this in spite of the fact.
Right.
It's that absurdness.
I would like the fear to be the instrument to get into negotiation, find out what the truth is. I don't want to avoid fear, but use it for the way it's intended.
Yeah. That's right. There are things there to be afraid of.
You bet.
Right. There are.
Well, certainly. Like I say, fear can be turned into paranoia so easily by, you know, it's easier to manipulate fear than it is to, you know, or to make people afraid. Just to, you know, if you kind of exist in a state of faith and in a state of fear, it's easier to look at things from a distance, which is what you have to do, is step back and look at it from a distance rather than from that perspective.
Other insights.
I was wondering when you mentioned the fireworks in the world and not of the world, were you implying that the military industrial complex is like the world?
Well, it's certainly a big part of the world, and I don't think the boundaries are distinct. I think we ought to assume that we're in it. I think we ought to assume that, you know, we may not be in the middle of it, but one way or another, I'm a teacher. What, 25% of the engineers work? You know, I think we'd have a difficulty finding anyone here who in one way or another was not in the military-industrial complex.
The system is part of the system. Yeah. We're all part of the political system.
That's right. So we are in it, but not of it. We accept the fact that we're in it, and that's a humbling experience. But we look to guidance beyond it. We have a certain rebellious spirit, not for the sake of standing out as being some sort of saints, but because we're called. And we're called beyond the system to question the system of which we are a part. Okay, that's what I...
Can we learn anything from recent military-industrial complexes? Say, going back to the German experience, the Japanese
yes.
experience, or this year, the El Salvador military... Yeah.
Very good. I think historians could help us an awful lot. One of the things they found at the end of World War II in Japan, just reading a book on this, they held the equivalent of the Nuremberg trials, and they couldn't find anybody really responsible. Certainly not the emperor of Japan. I mean, he had absolutely nothing to do with it. I mean, it was a great. It was there was a system, and I think as we get more of an understanding of Nazi Germany, we'll find out you can't just blame it on a few Nazis.
We were certainly brainwashed to you know, hate the Germans, hate the Japanese, but it wasn't the people, it was somebody else running the system.
Yeah. I think we can, certainly if you look at the German experience, I mean, here you had horrible kinds of things that were done very efficiently, very organized, killing people systematically. And I think if we go back and we look at the overwhelming majority of the people that were there, we have to say, we and they are one, those people. I mean, we were there. I don't think we can be arrogant and just assume that there were a few crazies running it, and all we have to do is get the crazies out. Yeah.
Japan announced recently that they wanted to start enlarging their old military organization.
Because the United States is pressing them.
Yeah. Well, the thing that worries me about that isn't the fact that they are going to enlarge their military to take over some of their own self-defense, but the development within Japan of an increased industrial complex. Because, you know the battle between, they're very good at what they do. And as soon as you start getting the powerful industrialists in that country starting to build up the military, they're going to be the ones that are going to be pushing the development of large military.
That's right.
And that's what concerns me. It's just like in the United States. Everything has a kind of a hiding.
And I, with respect to Japan, I'm torn between tremendous admiration. I mean, just, you know, awe. And an uneasiness, too. Because their educational system, from what I've read, is basically teaching people to fit into the system to a very large extent, much more than ours. The tradition of the university, for example, in the America came out of the churches, and where the quest for knowledge was a religious kind of thing. And that tradition, I think, has been carried on of independent inquiry. Well, the educational system in Japan, a large part of it, from what I understand, is very closely related to the industry. They're teaching people to be part of the industry. So I think they, as a people, ought to be a little bit cautious about this. The other thing that's promoting that military is, in addition to the United States, there is a certain almost insecurity in the sense of Japan, which is hard for Americans to understand because we think of them as supermen or women or whatever now. But there is kind of a cultural one that dates back, because you see in 1850s, they were still a feudal society. And when they came in contact with the Western world, they felt, in a sense, humiliated. And that thought may, among some people, may still persist, which I think they've proven themselves more than
Well, our educational system seems to be hooked in too, as one person observed. It takes about 12 years of our educational system to get a person ready to run a punch press.
I think that
to industry.
I think the parts of our educational system that hopefully try to prepare people to ask questions, we've got to nurture that part of our educational system. We really do, and I'm afraid that that might be withering away in order to be more productive and efficient than everything else. Yes?
Would you consider that the military-industrial complex era began, what, right at World War II?
That was a big push of it. I would say, though, that what we call, I think every age had to deal with its own complexes, the church complex or whatever, and I don't think we should look back in history and point to some glorious age when they didn't have those problems. But it is tied together with our Western technological way of thinking that I think it emerges. And that would be, you know, 15, 1600s, you begin to see some of that, and then the 17, 1800s as it growing. The thing that did happen after World War II, and Eisenhower mentions this for the American, this was the first major war where we didn't have a tremendous demobilization after the war, where we had to maintain a standing military-industrial complex. So that was a change after World War II. But the rationale, the way of thinking that supports our present way of military-industrial complex, has its roots in the scientific technological revolution, I think. So I agree with you in part.
Well, I wondered if it coincided with the reduction of agriculturalists. Because we don't need as many people in agriculture as we once did.
That was one of the things that went along with
they
it.
They go into industry to have jobs and so forth.
Right. Okay, thank you.